This is the Big Shift for Small Farms podcast. G'day listeners, I'm your host Edgars Greste. Did you know the soil has lots of secrets? Shh. But unlike some, the soil is willing to share theirs for those who are willing to take the time to watch and listen and do soil tests. In this episode, we're looking at the distinctive soils of the southeast region of New South Wales. We'll hear from two experts who've worked in the region for many years. But first, an inspiring story of change from a farming couple who were at their wits' end, chasing milk production targets until they found a simpler way. And it all started with observing their soils.
My name's Diana Ferguson.
My name's Stephen Shipton. Yeah, we're located in Coolagalight. We own three farms here next to Cobargo on the far south coast of New South Wales. We both had outside jobs and I'd moved back from Sydney and worked on this farm where the dairy is located. And that's how I became to meet Di on this farm, because that was her family farm. And so I worked there for sort of 4 years, 5 years, and then we had the opportunity to buy one of the partners out of the farm and go into dairying ourselves, which was back in 2004. So we started out in the dairy with a low input system. And as time progressed, we went with high intense types dairy farming, increased everything, whether it be fertiliser, grains, inputs. We noticed a lot of things that just went backwards, a lot of problems with soils, grass, cattle. The pastures was one in particular, no drought tolerance. Because we predominantly went through a lot of drought in our dairy time. And we get some good weather and then you see the pastures, as soon as you got a little bit of dry weather, the pastures would just diminish to nothing.
And cattle health, fertility. So we kept a database that measured what our cows were doing. And you know, we've got cattle there that had 13 years, you know, with us, and we know how many calves, their fat and protein. So every month we herd recorded. So we did have means to measure and look and say, hey, there's something going wrong here. And we were all very concerned about staying alive, you know, and keeping our farms profitable, because there was the bit of murmur about, you know, if we don't get bigger, then we'd have to get out, that sort of thing. So I think a lot of us as farmers around here were thinking, gee, how are we going to stay afloat? So it introduced a higher input model on farm. And we went in, you know, fertilising heavy with inorganics and
feeding the cattle.
Feeding them off the back of a truck. And I think we did a reasonable job looking after our cows, but still,
but
it didn't
mindset.
Matter what we were doing. We were still having problems. And that's when Steve started asking questions, and he'd say to our consultant, you know, I don't like just sowing one or two grasses, and how can it be just doing the same thing year in, year out? And you were the one initially that went searching, because you would come home and say, gee, the cows aren't full, you know, like what's going on? So we realised the nutrient density wasn't in the plants that we were growing. They looked amazing, but the nutrient density wasn't there, and they didn't have the resilience to the dry weather either. So as soon as it went dry, those pastures wouldn't perform, would they?
No, it was very hard to sustain grass in front of the cows. We had a lot of metabolic issues, so again, more and more inputs to try and
more
overcome
stress
those.
For us, you know.
Well, at the end of the day, the animal's stressed. That's the utmost thing you want to try and keep, but the stress on us to maintain it was also way up here.
And on the land.
Di and Stephen knew that something wasn't working on the farm, but couldn't put their finger on what. Without an answer, and with pressure from the industry to keep increasing production, it led them to follow conventional industry advice and just keep applying more inputs. And it was a decision to move away from dairy farming and into beef production that led them to look for a new direction.
We dairied for 16 years and we decided a change was needed. We were tired and we just wanted a bit more family time as well, thinking about that. And time to get away. The beef side of things was very lucrative to enable that to happen. And it also gave us time to reevaluate what we were doing on with our land and whatnot. So that gave us that opportunity. Back in about 2010 is where I started. I think it was a soil course came up in Bega, which was to do with the Kinsey Albrecht system. And that started us on a path of recovery, so to speak. So then in, I think it was 2012, I went to New Zealand and looked at soils and different things to do with minerals. We did soil tests, obviously. We went down the path of minerals and what else we needed inputs, whether it's calcium, magnesiums, Cal-Mag ratios, all those types of things. So that was the way that we sort of started out to buy the soil tests and started to improve things, organic matters, those types of things. But again, it just wasn't enough. So we just thought we needed to go a step further, and that's where I researched more, and hence we got onto, yeah, the soil food web. And then again, Alan Savory, I think, was a book that I'd read to do with holistic management. That really made things all come together with the grazing management. Everything else can work and it's great, but unless you got that management right, nothing will happen. It just will not work.
For Di and Stephen, finding a new approach to farming was just one part of the journey. Changing their mindset from old habits was the next step.
I was raised in the old style way of farming, with ploughing and cropping, fertilising. To change those practices to what we do now, it's a major shift. It's very hard to go back on tradition. It's been a hell of a learning curve. Yeah, I found the old track was
boring.
Yeah, I found it a bit boring, and this just broadens your horizon, and we've just kept it very, very basic.
A big focus of Stephen's holistic management of the farm is rotational grazing. Mobs of cattle are moved through large paddocks divided into sections or cells. This allows for intense grazing followed by long rest periods for pasture recovery.
We've kept fairly wide open paddocks. I use strip fencing a lot because I change my method every time I go into a paddock depending on grass quantities and whatnot, and the given times of cattle numbers at the time, where water points are. The strip fences, that's cheap and effective. We basically just, where am I going to put up the next strip fence?
It's been difficult to change, you know, the mindset, but it's been a really positive change. Instead of growing the farm and getting bigger, we think, well, we can get some nutrient-dense plants growing, get the diversity. And then that's when the tree side of things started to come in too, didn't it? Mm. Valuing having the wildlife, the tree corridors, and even the weeds, you know.
The ecosystem.
Yeah. And often we'll be chatting and I'll say to Steve, or he'll come back to me and say, oh, I saw all these spiders, you know, because back when we were high input, we sprayed. We didn't like it, and that was another thing. We always tried to do it without the spray, but say preparing for your winter, you know, spray out. And the other thing that came about, we started getting attacked. What was it? The red-legged earth mite.
Red-legged earth mite was a big one.
Never had a problem with.
Yeah,
they were probably there, but not prolific.
We asked consultants about them, and oh no, they just come around. But we've eliminated those now.
For Di and Stephen, many of the problems they were facing were a result of their mechanical approach to farming. And it was following their own intuition that led them to reconnect with a more natural solution in the soil.
When you start to understand that there's life in the soil and, you know, we're hearing the birds here and amongst the trees, and it's nice, isn't it? Not having to think about tons of fertiliser that we have to order and then the price of that, that's a significant pressure.
Yeah, well, you haven't got the weight on your shoulders. It's a far simpler system.
Instead of manipulating everything, you've just got to work with the land and what's in front of you.
Yeah, my way of looking at the future is everyone should try and look outside the square and have a look at these types of approaches, because for where we're heading and environment and whatever in the world, carbon sequestration, this is the way to go. It is far more sustainable instead of just having inputs and inputs, whether it's diesel inputs or fuel or fertilisers or whatnot. The less you can rely on that and go with nature, that's what I see as the future.
For Di and Stephen, their farming journey has seen them change both their mindset and their practices. And it all started with questioning the very ground they were standing on, here in the soils of the southeast coast. And to learn more about these particular soils, we met with local Roy Laurie.
I'm a semi-retired soil scientist after a long career in the Department of Primary Industries.
Like anyone with a passion for their work, Roy hasn't hung up the lab coat or the spade just yet. He's a member of the Soil Knowledge Network, a passionate group of people full of soil facts.
It's like the soils itself. there's not much of us there, and we're spread very thinly all over the landscape.
Roy met with us at a local farm in Berry, and like any soil scientist worth his or her salt, with a captive audience, Roy got to work sharing the good dirt on soil, and he started with a poster that he'd brought with him.
You probably notice on this poster here that there's the different features of the soil. It looks very confusing to start with, but all soils have certain things in common.
Now, because this is a podcast, I need you to picture the poster that Roy is talking about. Now, imagine a slice of cake with lots of layers. It's not a rainbow cake or a tiramisu. Google chocolate mousse cake and turn your phone upside down and you'll get an idea of what I'm thinking of. But what do all these cakes have in common?
They have layers in them. We call them horizons in a scientific sense. So you have a dark topsoil. There's one there. And underneath that, you have a pale zone like these ones here. This is quite common in the southeast, by the way, this pale zone. It doesn't occur everywhere. And then below that, you have usually, not always, a dense clay layer.
Now, Roy's described a number of different layers, but he says that some people only see that top layer and don't think further below.
Many people have a different view of soil. So they only look at that part of the profile and think, oh, that's all the soil I've got. But if you go deeper than that and you see plant roots in it, the plants are getting something out of that. Why would they put their roots there if they weren't? So when scientists look at soil, they come up with these fancy names. Most of the time, the name is based on the properties of the subsoil and not the topsoils, because the topsoils are all pretty much look the same. They're a dark greyish-brown colour, yet their properties and management are quite different, because here in Australia and in the East Coast too, moisture is the dominant factor controlling plant growth.
Roy simplifies the strategy for farmers. His advice is clear. Focus on the topsoil. And the reason he emphasises focusing on this part is that you can actually tweak this, modify it and improve it more effectively compared to other subsoils.
Which part of the profile should people worry about? Okay, they should worry about the surface soil, because that's the layer that they can change if it hasn't got properties that suits them. You can modify the properties of that layer. Try and modify the properties of the subsoil. It doesn't work unless you wait a very long time where you've got deep pockets and want to spend a lot of money. So that surface layer is something you look after very much. That surface layer is where possibly 90% of the nutrients that plants need comes from, but not all the moisture though. Yeah, they get a good proportion of the moisture out of that layer, yeah. But the moisture properties of that surface layer are critical, because it's got to be able to absorb rainfall.
Now, one thing that Roy said earlier is that most topsoils all look quite similar, but their management is very different and unique for the particular region that you're going to find that soil in. And so to get a better idea of how we should be working with the soils of the southeast coast, we spoke with Andrew Britton. He's a former small farms coordinator for the South Coast region, and he shared some insights on the significance of doing soil tests, which is one of the first places to start.
I'm Andrew. I've been working on the South Coast from the Illawarra right down to the Shoalhaven and across the Tablelands for close to 18 years, and have spent a lot of time working with small landholders in improving sustainable agriculture and natural resource management across their farms.
Andrew goes into a bit of depth, literally, of how far down you should go with doing soil tests.
So when you're doing your soil test, you're doing your 0 to 10. And then if you're looking at subsoil acidity, around maybe looking at potential acid sulfate soil issues or acidity to depth, you're going 10 to 20. So with those soil tests, it gives you a really good indicator of where your soils are sitting and whether there's key nutrients that it might be missing. So we used to talk about, in programs like LandScan, the holes in your bucket. There's no point trying to put on excess nutrient if the bucket's still got major holes, whether it's phosphorus or nitrogen or something else. So the key thing is getting those soil tests to at least 0 to 10, if you can, 10 to 20, to give you a really good idea of what's happening in your soil. Majority of the grassroots are going to be sitting in that 0 to 10 sort of profile, and your deeper species like Phalaris and and Kaikoura and whatever will push down into that 10 to 20. So to be able to make sure that you provide the right nutrients, the right fertilizer to address the deficiencies within your soils will make a huge difference in terms of your pasture production. So we know on the coast that most of our soils are acidic and most paddocks could do with lime, but it's a matter of looking at the economics and what your goals are in terms of production. So it's finding that balance and getting an idea of what you need to put on to hit your production and management goals.
Andrew, when you're working with farmers to start prioritising those goals, what's the first step that you normally do with them?
When we go out and see landholders, maybe for the first time, or we've engaged with them a number of times about different issues, for me, it's about getting some benchmark data. So it's understanding where they're at in their journey, so what their expectations are and what where they want to achieve. Over, you know, it could be a 12-month, could be a 3-year, could be a 5-year cycle, or even 10 years. The key thing for us, and which we encouraged all landholders to do, is to go get a soil test. So you can't improve or start looking at improving your land until you've got the base knowledge and base data from soil tests. So we are pretty lucky on the South Coast. A lot of our soils are very fertile. There is certainly areas which are quite acidic, but generally on that coastal strip, between the Illawarra and the Shoalhaven, we've got fairly fertile soils. But in saying that, they're still quite acidic. So we need to get a bit of an idea through simple soil tests, a soil test per paddock, to get an idea of what the variation is across your farm. And then we can create a plan to address some of those major holes within the soil test. So it's not a matter of just spreading fertilizer and letting the grass grow, because unless you know what's missing, the key elements, you may not get a response from that fertilizer, or you may get a massive response and then you grow far too much grass for the amount of cows that you got and you waste it. So it's about understanding where your farm is up at to, where you are in your journey and where you want to sort of go, and creating a plan. And soil testing is a key part of that process.
One farmer that Andrew has worked with over the years is Wayne Brown, who lives just outside the picturesque town of Berry.
He's about 4 km into town. They've got 100 acres here. It goes down as far as the tree line down there, which is Kermanderry Swamp. I've had the farm 23 years. I'm farming beef cattle. I've got, they're down along the fence line down there at the moment. Angus, I've got no other plans to move from here. It's nice and peaceful, nice and quiet.
I probably met Wayne back in 2004. I think he was part of our original Small Farms Network membership. So Wayne and I sort of go back quite a bit. Wayne's been part of the Shoalhaven Beef Producers Association and part of the show, and turned up to a lot of events. And we've done quite a few soil tests with Wayne over the years. So Wayne's got quite a varied landscape on his property. So he's got the hills above Kermanderry Swamp, and then he's got some really quite fertile but acidic flats that run into the swamp. So it's quite diverse.
Yeah, I normally get the test done at least every 18 months. So the challenges are that I have various readings of what the soil is, so it's not consistent all the way through. You get down closer to the swamp, it's a little bit more acidic. Up top of here, it's fairly shaley underneath, so there's a bit of a difference there. Mm. Yeah, and it just depends on the weather as well, because once it rains, if it rains hard and heavy, the ground pugs up a lot from the cattle walking all over it, and then you get these real dry spells, and it's, yeah, put the bike on it, and it's a bit hard. But I found after, it doesn't take much, but after that rain we had a couple of weeks ago, the shaking isn't as bad. So it's a bit of a spongy feel back into the ground again.
Soil scientist Roy Laurie, who we heard from earlier, visited Wayne's farm with us. With soil test results in hand, we went out into the paddock to understand how the different soil types are reflected in the results of the soil tests and what challenges Wayne has to deal with.
We had two contrasting profiles here, one up on the close to the road here, just through the gate there, and up on the top here, it was much drier. A different pasture scenario up here. You had more Kaikoura up here. See, then the colour of that, the dark colours associated with the organic matter content. It's riddled with plant roots. They're all the way through. They're sucking out all the goodies resulting from the decay of the soil organic matter. Bit of cow pat on the surface. Yeah. And when you can put your hand in the soil like that and come up with a handful of soil, that's a sign of good structure because the soil is not sitting like a brick.
Walking the land is a really great way to get a sense of the different soil types on the farm. And as they head down to the bottom of the property, they get a feel for an entirely different soil type and conditions.
And another one down near the bottom of the slope. And we saw that boggy condition that Wayne's talking about at the lower slope down there. And it's certainly more acidic down there. And down the bottom there, you had things that more paspalum and other things that don't mind getting wet.
Different soil types are going to attract different types of grasses, even undesirable ones. Enter a universal challenge for farmers worldwide: persistent issues of weeds. And in this region, there are specific weed varieties that particularly trouble farmers. Wayne sheds light on some struggles, focusing on the challenges posed by Parramatta grass.
It is something terrible. Cattle won't eat it. They'll graze on it when it's small and the leaf is fairly soft. But once it gets up, it is as tough as anything. So I've tried to spray it out, but with the giant Parramatta grass, the seed will lay dormant in the ground for up to 7 years. So you've got that challenge that, oh, look, I've got rid of it all. And if you can have a look out there, you can see a row when it was sprayed, it was missed. And you've got all this stuff that was there, and that's one of the challenges of it. Now these days, all I tend to do is cut it down in winter time. I'll slash it, but in summertime, I'll put the wick wiper over it with a bit of glyphosate and try and get rid of it that way.
Weeds, like all plants, increase when the temperature and moisture is just right for them. It's no surprise then that most weeds tend to flourish in more welcoming conditions. So fertile soil is holding up a welcome sign to them. It's a big challenge for farmers. And Andrew Britton, who we heard from earlier, gives us some insight and recommendations into how best to manage some of the major weeds in the area.
In terms of the two major weeds that we've been managing on the coast for small landholders, or landholders in general, has been fireweed and Parramatta grass. Fireweed's really been challenging to manage because it's a windborne seed. So with our strong westerly winds, it's spreading across the country quite freely. But out of the two, fireweed is quite easy to control in terms of, you know, management techniques, slashing, hand pulling. A lot of our environmental work has been creating shelter belts across windswept landscapes like the Milton Monzonite area down around Kruger, creating those windbreaks to stop that weed seed flying across the landscape and dropping into these buffer zones and trying to reduce the spread. And we've seen that work really well in particular areas, whether it is around Berry and around Wayne's place, around Agar's Lane. We've done a lot of plantings over the years, but in particular the Monzonite area around Kruger Road, working with a lot of small landholders down there, creating those buffer zones and dairy farms, I believe we've made a significant difference in terms of managing the spread of fireweed with some really good education and some dedicated farmers doing a number of different control methods. We've made a difference in that. Parramatta grass is a different thing altogether. It's very invasive and very hard to get out once it gets in. The seed bank it produces is significant. So the seed is staying in the soil for at least 7 or more years. So even though you may chemically control it or increase the production of your pastures to try to outcompete it, the seed's there. So one of the biggest things we've noticed over the last 20 years is the change in rainfall on the south coast. So I guess I've been on the south coast since 2001. And back then, the rainfall was a bit more consistent. So we'd have showers, fine weather, showers. It just seemed to just roll quite nicely. What we've noticed over the last 10 years in particular, we're getting significant downpours. And then we got extended dry periods, which is causing this huge growth of pasture, and then it's dying off. And from that period of dryness, which could be a month, it could be up to 2 months, the pasture is dying off, the gaps are opening, and those weeds are just taking the taken the opportunity to invade that space where the competitive pastures has dried off and died or been grazed too heavily, or the fertility is not quite there to carry it through those dry spells. So definitely the change in climate conditions has resulted on the average landholder's property to allow these invasive species like Parramatta grass, I believe, to really take off.
But it's not an impossible situation, and there are many different methods that you can try to keep the beast at bay.
When Parramatta grass first came in onto the south coast, we were really encouraging those landholders who might have had a small infestation to really jump onto it early. So whether that's chipping the tussocks out, whether it's fencing it off, looking at key biosecurity measures in terms of not slashing it and spreading the seed source, or because the seed on the Parramatta grass is quite sticky, encouraging landholders not to move their cattle early in the morning so the seed will stick to the livestock and move it to paddock, washing down their vehicles or their tractors if they're going from one paddock to the other, which is not always possible. But when you know you've only got a small infestation, trying to control it quickly before it spreads is really important. So there's a number of really key probably biosecurity pasture management and livestock management tools that you can learn to minimise the spread of invasive species and weeds on your property.
In summary, Andrew says that the key to minimising weeds lies in prioritising above-ground management practices. And this includes establishing an environment where competitive grasses can effectively outperform the weeds.
Certainly one of the things that we recommend and talk to landholders about is, as part of their journey, is quite often not rushing. If you've got the time to sit back and watch and learn and observe your farm in terms of areas that get wet, areas that dry out quicker, areas that respond to a little bit of fertiliser or the weeds pop up a little bit more, if you can do that for at least 12 months or 18 months, that'll give you a really good idea of where your farm is at, and then you can be a bit more flexible in terms of how hard you graze paddocks, where you need to move your cattle, what paddocks you can drive for production when you need to, and what paddocks you need to sort of pull back when it starts to get dry or gets too wet. In terms of improving your pastures, something that we always, again, talk about in our prograze sessions and other workshops is trying to improve 10% of your property every couple of years. So that could be, again, picking your better paddocks and introducing a clover or a ryegrass or, you know, a winter sort of feed system across 10% of your property. So it gives you that feed opportunity during the winter months where, you know, the kikuyu and everything else stops. If you're improving one or two paddocks a year with some winter species or some other grasses, it gives you that viability throughout the year. So if you do have a little spreader or something, it's a really good idea to go, if I get my soil test, how about if I spread a little bit of urea or nitrogen, or I might try a super product and do it in strips and just see what sort of response I get. If I get a response, fantastic, let's replicate it across the paddock. If I don't get a response, then you can go back to your farmer store or to your ag advisor and go, I tried this, didn't get a response, and ask the question why. And it can be purely, you know, 2 meters by 5 meters or a 10 meter little patch, little strip across your paddocks, whether it's in the upper profile, you know, if you've got a sloping property, you could do it up the top of your paddock, mid paddock and lower paddock, and just see what variations in pasture growth occur, and that'll give you a bit of an idea, just a really quick, easy, simple visual idea of the response you would get if you spread that right across your paddocks. And what a lot of landholders talk about as well is observing their cattle. The cattle will graze in particular areas because the grass is sweeter or something like that. But having those observations, the landholders do notice those little obvious little changes. So even if you may not get a significant pasture response, actually watching where your cattle graze will give you a bit of an idea of whether it's worked as well. So not very scientific, but it's certainly something that landholders talk about when you go out on farm. You go, I notice this is where they're grazing because of X, Y, and Z. And you go, okay, that's really interesting. That gives you a bit of an idea of, you know, it could be pasture species. It could be something that you've done in terms of your management, which has resulted in the pastures being more appetizing for the animals to graze. The important thing is don't rush and ask questions and get involved in local groups. Reach out to the support officers, whether it's an ag officer or a livestock officer. The free advice is there. Make the most of it and enjoy it. Enjoy the journey.
The soils of the southeast coast of New South Wales offer farmers some unique challenges. But no matter where you're based, soil tests are a really important part of understanding what your soil needs and what decisions you need to make to help contribute to the improvement of your farm. The Big Shift podcast is proudly produced by Grow Love Project in partnership with Greater Sydney Local Land Services. Thanks to all our guests who've generously shared their time and their stories. To find out more about the opportunities they've talked about, we've provided some links in the show notes. And remember, if you like what you heard, please share it. Thanks for listening.